Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome to yet another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Just a reminder before we kick everything off, next weekend will be the Animus Morgue Takeover, where my part-time co-host, Jerry Hartman, will be taking over for the entire episode and interviewing both myself and AK Herrera. Who the fuck knows what he's going to be interviewing us about. We don't have the slightest fucking clue, and we're both a little terrified of what he might be asking us, but like I said before, either way, I'm sure it'll be great fun. So for this episode, since this weekend is the unofficial start of next week's 83rd annual Bike Week here in Myrtle Beach, I thought I'd talk about a few movies that dealt with bikers, with biker horror, I guess is the best way to put it. So let's not waste any time and get right into it with 1973's Psychomania.
They were just ordinary troublemakers as long as they lived. But they return from beyond the grave with superhuman powers, unleashing an unholy reign of terror that holds an entire community in the grip of psychomania. Psychomania.
Everybody dies, don't they? But some come back. How do the dead come back, Mother?
When you die, you've got to believe that you're going to come back.
You can only die once. After that, nothing and nobody can harm you.
Psychomania.
Before I get into any of these, none of the movies I'm going to talk about this episode are very good. But if you're a fan of low-budget horror movies like I am, you should find something in them to amuse yourself with. But like I said, they're not particularly good and definitely aren't essential watching. Tom Latham, a nice enough psychopath and the leader of a violent teen gang named The Living Dead, enjoys riding his motorcycle with his girlfriend Abby and loves his mother. Tom dabbles in black magic and spends much time at an ancient ruin located in the Surrey countryside known as the Seven Witches, which is a Stonehenge-like circle of standing stones. In a similar vein, his mother and her sinister butler, Shadwell, get their kicks out of holding seances in their home while they worship some sort of frog god. Tom's father vanishes in a mysterious room shortly after Tom's birth, a room which Tom enters on his 18th birthday and where he sees the frog god. This incident leads to Tom committing suicide, and with his mother's help, Tom returns from the dead. Being one of the undead means that Tom cannot be killed and has superhuman strength, which he demonstrates when he massacres the people drinking at the local pub. One by one, his fellow bikers all commit suicide with the goal of returning as one of the undead, gathering at the Seven Witches to plan their campaign of terror against the locals. However, Abby refuses and is the only one that doesn't commit suicide. Police Chief Inspector Hasseltine is overwhelmed by the crime wave committed by bikers who are known to be dead. Believing that someone is stealing the corpses of the dead bikers, he releases a false report that Abby has died. Hasseltine and the other police plan to trap the culprit when he shows up to claim Abby, and Tom and the other bikers kill all the policemen while seizing Abby. However, Tom's mother grows disgusted with the crimes committed by her son and decides to break her bargain with the frog god. Tom and the other bikers tell Abby to commit suicide, but she once again refuses to, instead shooting Tom, who is immune to the bullets. As Tom prepares to kill Abby, his mother performs a ritual which breaks the pact, and Tom's mother is transformed into a frog, while Tom and the rest of the undead bikers are turned into stone, becoming new standing stones at the Seven Witches. And Abby is left alone, surrounded by the stones that were once her friends, as the movie ends. Also known as Death Wheelers, this one is pretty over the top, and it's listed, in, or has been listed, in a lot of the worst movies ever list. But it is what it is, and it works as such. What it is a British B-movie made very cheaply and with a clear agenda to cash in on both the zombie and motorcycle youth genres that were going on at the time. With a clear agenda to cash in on both of these, like I said. Most of the acting in this is pretty bad. With the actors who can only do limited work with the material they're given. But probably would not do much better with more fleshed out dialogue, I guess is the best way to put it. And having said that, the dialogue in this is pretty terrible as well. But there are more than a few way over the top deaths. As like I said when I was talking about the plot of the movie, the bikers are all trying to commit suicide so they can come back as the undead. And as a result, like I said, there are some pretty over-the-top deaths in this. However, there is some pretty cool stunt work done with the motorcycles. So that and the over-top deaths are enough for anybody that's a fan of bad B-movies to watch this. You will definitely be entertained. IMDb gave this a 5.7 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a surprising 86%. Letterboxd a 2 out of 5. And I give it a 3 out of 5. Next up, we have 1971's Werewolves on Wheels.
One who speaks for them, let them eat their bread and drink their wine, and in the night benign, sleep.
Don't miss the most unusual and exciting horror motorcycle film yet made.
I come to offer you youth and fresh blood.
Hey, we all know how we're going to die, baby. We're going to crash and burn.
Werewolves on Wheels, starring Steve Oliver and Severn Darden. The story of a motorcycle gang who ride into a new kind of hell. They ride wild, play hard, and fight brutal.
I write your unholy name thrice in black.
By a Satan, you are one with them. By a Satan, you are one with them. By a Satan.
Werewolves on of Wheels, the most eerie, the most chilling, the most terrifying motorcycle horror film ever made. Their survival was the torch, as one by one they became terrifying, bloodthirsty werewolves on wheels. The first horror motorcycle film ever made, Werewolves on Wheels. Rated R from the Fanfare Corporation.
This movie follows the tracks of a California biker gang, the Devil's Advocates, as they speed across the barren highway on a drug-infused journey of undisclosed intent. Losing their way, the group stops for the night on the grounds of a church tucked away in some hills off the beaten path. Much to their initial pleasure, they are fed by a kindly group of hooded priests before settling into a deep, inebriated stupor. As a group of bikers moves across the desert, they come across that night, the cultists cast a curse on the biker's leader's girlfriend that makes her turn into a werewolf after nightfall. She soon infects her boyfriend, and the bikers leave the church and begin to be killed off whenever they stop for the night. Things come to a climax when a couple changes in front of the bikers, who quickly kill the werewolves. The bikers then return to the church to have their revenge, but stop when they see themselves in the cult procession. A mix of outlaw biker and the traditional horror movie. This movie really isn't the best, and the budget really makes this quite fucking clear. The werewolves themselves look pretty fucking terrible. You can tell that they're just actors in what pretty much equals to a dime store werewolf mask and hair on their hands. It's really pretty fucking bad, but it's so bad, it's good and hilarious as fuck. The acting is pretty terrible all around, although there are a few actors that aren't terrible, but 90% of the acting is bad, and the dialogue, once again, is pretty bad as well. So it's definitely not one I would have you watch unless you have nothing better to watch and for some reason come across it on TV, but I highly doubt you will. Because this movie has pretty much vanished off the face of the earth. I don't even think there's physical copies left anymore. I have one. I don't even remember how the fuck I got it. And I actually kind of forgot that I had it until I was rewatching all these movies for this episode. And I'm kind of glad that I forgot I had it after watching it. IMDb rated this 4.3 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 20%. Letterboxd gave it a 1%. And I give it a 1.5. 1.5 out of 5. And that brings us to 1989's Shopper Chicks in Zombie Town.
They are creatures of darkness, waiting for their moment to strike, waiting to prey on the innocent, and no power on earth can stop them. They're bad! They're beautiful! They're
eight broads on the rag.
Troma is proud to present Billy Bob Thornton in the Tromillennium edition of Chopper Chicks in Zombie Town.
For the love of men! For the love of animals!
Yo, the dog!
For the love of God, does anyone know how to stop them?
Bring back the dead.
All these people are dead?
They're dead!
They're going to eat you,
bitch!
Now, it's the Queens of Ghoul!
Nobody runs me out of town.
Against the zombie ghoul!
Just my husband, you think?
Your husband's dead!
In a war that's got everyone losing their head.
No respect for the dead.
you?
Chopper Chicks in Zombie Town. Not just another action comedy horror biker zombie movie.
Blow me.
This movie is about an all-female motorcycle gang named the Cycle Sluts, who cruise into the isolated town of Zariah looking for a good time. They find an evil scientist turned mortician who has been killing local townspeople with the aid of its long-suffering dwarf assistant and turning them into zombies to use as to use as labor at an abandoned mine. The mine is too radioactive after underground nuclear tests to be mined by normal living people. So once again, the zombies are used to do this. Although the scientist later admits that the real reason he has been doing it this is not the money, but just because he's a plain mean asshole. The zombies escape after a curious little boy removes the lock to explore the mine, becoming the zombie's first victim. Around this point, a busload of blind orphans become stranded just on the outskirts of town as their ride breaks down. Luckily for them, their bus driver always keeps an Uzi on the bus for sentimental reasons. With vague memories of life to guide them, the zombies eventually find their way back to town and begin devouring live flesh. Going against the wishes of their leader and despite some rough treatment from the locals earlier on in the film, the Cycle Sluts ride to the rescue and begin killing the zombies using chainsaws, baseball bats, welding torches, a garrow, and a staple gun. The Cycle Sluts use fresh meat to lure the remaining zombies to the town church, which they have packed with dynamite. They are now aided by the Doctor's Dwarf, who has decided that there are better lines of work than being a henchman. With all the undead inside and the church sealed up, the timer goes off, and the church goes up in flames, zombies and all. The Cycle Sluts are then rewarded with a sack full of cash and induct the dwarf and several of the blind orphans as honorary Cycle Sluts. They then ride out of town with some of the menfolk in tow, and throw the sack of money to the wind as the end credits roll. This movie was brought to us from those fine purveyors of schlocky, trashy B-horror movies, Troma. And if you've seen a movie produced by Troma before, you pretty much know what you're in store for with this. If not, there's pretty much something in every Troma movie that is going to offend pretty much everybody that's a little overly sensitive. And in this movie, if you're a feminist, it's definitely going to offend you. So if you are, not that there's anything wrong with that, I highly recommend you avoid this. like I said, it has pretty much everything in it you expect from a Troma movie. Bad acting, bad effects, stupid as shit dialogue, but it's all entertaining enough. They're so bad, they're good movies. The zombie makeup in this sucks. It's pretty much just normal people stumbling and walking around in tattered and torn clothes. And the effects really suck. Like when there's decapitations, you can tell that, that's obviously just like a prop dummy's head and or limb or something like that. But it's all in good fun, and it's definitely entertaining if you can stomach it. Like I said, there's something in every Troma movie that will at least, or that will offend the majority of people that watch it. But it's still a good watch, even though it's pretty bad. IMDb gave this a 4.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, a 25%. Letterboxd, a 2.5 out of 5. And I give it a 3.3 out of 5. Next up, we have 1988's Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Reflect for a moment on the art of cinema. Think of a motion picture like The Last Emperor and the 9 Academy Awards it so richly deserved. Consider the profound emotional experience of a truly great film. Then forget it, sweetheart.
Yes, better blow it out your exhaust pipe, cinema lover, because here comes fun with hair on it.
Oh, that's disgusting.
You're gonna see the biggest piece of shattering entertainment that ever molested your sensibilities.
That sounds great.
What a plot? Here it is. It's the end of the 20th century, and mankind has blown its wad. The fate of humanity rests in the groin of one man.
Their leader, Commander Toady, has kidnapped some pilgrims who wandered into their territory. We're gonna get them out, and then you're gonna get them pregnant.
Yes, if you want a brilliant film, you can go right to...
We're going to Frog Town.
Hell comes to Frog Town. Starring wrestling superstar, Rowdy Roddy Piper. Move over, Mr. Mel Gibson and Mr. Robert De Niro. Here comes acting talent and sensitivity like you've never seen.
You're one weird dude.
And speaking of talent, turn green, Ms. Meryl Streep. Here's Sandahl Bergman, the exquisite star of Red Sonja and Conan the Barbarian. Hell comes to Frog Town, a story of mutant sex and people like you and me. It's hot, it's wet,
and it's bad.
It's Hell Comes to Frog Town.
This movie is set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland where few fertile men and women exist due to atomic fallout. As a result, the government places a high priority on those who can still breed. Shortly before the movie opens, a group of mutant amphibians who have been exiled to the desert by humans capture a group of fertile women and are using them as sex slaves. Sam Hell, a nomadic traveler who wanders the countryside, is first seen tied to a chair and smashed over the head with a bottle by a man whose daughter he sexually assaulted. He is eventually captured by an organization of warrior nurses, the closest thing to a government in his region of the world, who reveal that they located him by tracking the trail of pregnant women left in his wake. Their original plan was to use him as breeding stock with their collection of fertile women, but this was a group captured by the mutants. With their own attempts to capture the women failing, the group presses Hell into service as a mercenary, who is to infiltrate the mutant city, referred to as Frogtown, and rescue the women. To make sure that the rebellious Hell follows his orders, he is forced to wear an electronic protective codpiece that will explode if he disobeys or tries to abort his mission. Having already had numerous samples of his reproductive material taken, he is now deemed far more expendable than the women themselves. To aid him in his mission and make sure that he follows the plan, he is paired with one of the nurses, Spangle, and an aggressive guard named Sentinella. During their journey to Frogtown, Hell tries numerous times to escape, but quickly learns that a device Spangle carries will shock his genitals if used or if he gets too far away from it. Despite their rocky start and Spangle's initial cold demeanor, the pair grows closer during the journey and eventually fall in love. When they reach Frogtown, everyone involved is captured. The frog's second-in-command, Bull, tortures Hell and attempts to remove the copies for its technology. Meanwhile, a slightly drugged Spangle is forced to work as a slave and dance for the frog's commander, Toady, in the notable Dance of the Three Snakes sequence. Proving more successful than she had wished, the nurse soon finds herself at the mercy of the aroused commander. However, with the copies now removed, because Bull finally removed it with a chainsaw, but it blew up and killed him. The escaped Hell rescues her along with a group of fertile women that had been held captive, and they all ride into the sunset as the movie ends. Now, this one is really fucking weird. It's kind of a spoof of post-apocalyptic movies like Mad Max or Escape from New York, mixed with traditional horror movie. It's quite obvious that none of this is really meant to be taken seriously, and it's all done with tongue-in-cheek. But while it is a pretty bad movie, it is still one that's pretty fucking entertaining. There is plenty of terrible acting and cheesy sets. it's quite obvious that none of this takes place where they say it does in the movie. The acting is quite terrible, like I said. But it still enters enough entertainment, like most of these movies that I've talked about. If you can look past all the terribleness of it. The effects are pretty bad. For the frog mutants, Toady, he does have a pretty cool costume, where the frog head is all animatronic, and it actually looks pretty decent and pretty badass, if I'm to tell the truth. But the rest of the frog mutants, it's quite obvious they're in, like, I don't know how to describe it, like a half badly made rubber mask. But like I said, Toady's mask and even Bull's mask is pretty cool. And that's probably the best part. Those are probably the two best costumes in this movie. IMDb gave this a 5.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes at 56%. Letterboxd 2 out of 5. And I give it a 3 out of 5. And that leads us into 1985's The Nail Gun Massacre. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a trailer for this, like, at all. So I'm just going to talk about the movie. The movie opens at a construction site in East Texas where 6 men gang rape Linda Jenkins. 5 months later, a person in camouflage clothing and black motorcycle helmet kills one of the rapists with a nail gun. 1 month later, another rapist, Mark, cuts some wood with his friend Brad. As Brad takes a piss, the killer shoots him in the crotch and stomach with the nail gun. And as Mark revs up the chainsaw, the killer sneaks up behind him and shoots him in the back of the neck. Mark then falls, and the chainsaw severs his hand. When Doc, the town doctor and coroner, arrives at the crime scene, the sheriff shows him the bodies. The doctor then mentions that 3 bodies have been found on Old Lady Bailey's property, and the sheriff asks the wife of the first murder victim if her husband was a carpenter, and he then leaves to call the meat wagon. The killer then picks up a hitchhiker, then shoots him in the stomach, causing him to jump out of the moving vehicle. He then stops the car and kills the hitchhiker. The sheriff and Doc are called to the hardware store where a young woman was found nailed behind the store. Minutes later, they are called to the road outside of town where the hitchhiker was nailed to the concrete in the middle of the road. Maxine, John, and Tom are eating at a diner where she reveals Old Bailey let them stay in a house for free because someone was murdered there. The next day, the trio buys lumber from the lumber yard to fix the house. Hal and Ben arrive with their girlfriends Ann and Trish to ask the owner Bubba for a job. He tells them of Maxine's place and the group leaves. And after they leave, Linda shows up and asks Bubba if the 2 men were construction workers. At Maxine's place, the group sees no one at home and sit on a blanket for a picnic. Hal and Ann go for a walk in the woods and fuck. They are then killed and nailed to a tree by the killer. Trish urges Ben to go out to look for them, and the killer nails Ben's hands to a tree. Maxine, John, and Tom then return to the house, and John comforts a friend in Trish. John and Tom discover the bodies of Hal, Ben, and Ann, and call the sheriff. They unload the lumber from the truck, and Maxine voices her worries about the killer. They then also find that their nail gun is missing. The next day, 2 carpenters are working on a house when they playfully shoot at each other with nail guns. When they go back into the partially constructed house, the killer shoots one in the head. And then the killer, speaking for the first time with a distorted voice, tells the other carpenter to think back 6 months ago. When a carpenter mentions a raping, the killer kills him. The killer then murders a couple making out on the hood of their car and a family man in a suburban house. After following various leads, the sheriff eventually realizes 6 of the victims worked at a construction site 6 months ago. Linda Jenkins, now established to be Bubba's sister, was raped after delivering supplies at that site. The 6 rapists walked away thanks to the lack of evidence. Later that evening, 2 women walking in a nearby woods are attacked and killed. The next morning, Doc calls Linda and asks to speak to Bubba. but she hangs up on him. Doc then drives over to the lumberyard and confronts Linda, who tells him Bubba is out driving his hearse. Doc and Linda drive along the road and find the hearse and give chase. Soon the sheriff joins them and the chase leads to a textile factory. The killer then exits the car and runs, pursued by the sheriff and Doc. They chase the killer through the factory to the limestone mounds. The killer then climbs up a crane, but slips and falls to his death. Linda walks up to the dead killer and removes his helmet, revealing him to be Bubba. The killing's now over. Doc walks away with the traumatized Linda as the end credits roll. This is pretty much a long, long forgotten slasher, and for good cause. It's very, very cheaply made, with Hershey syrup for the blood, some quite obviously rubber nails, and some terrible fucking acting. It's not hard to see why this slasher was forgotten and lost among all the more popular slashers that were coming out during the 80s at the time that this movie was released. My biggest complaint about this movie is that every time the killer speaks, they do it in like a distorted voice that kind of makes him sound like Freddy Krueger just a little bit. But the big problem with this is that the dude's wearing a fucking motorcycle helmet. So everything that comes out of his mouth, which is already muffled by the voice-changing thing that they're using, it even comes out even more muffled because of the fucking helmet. And you can't understand a fucking word that he's saying. So pretty much every line of dialogue that he says, even though there isn't a lot that we hear from him, is pretty much useless because you can't understand a goddamn word that he's saying. And it's also hilariously obvious. And if you watch closely, if you can find this, you'll see what I'm talking about. But when you watch the killer run, you'll see that he runs exactly like a girl. And this is because the stunt double for the killer, or the stunt doubles, sorry, for the killer, were all women. So every time you see the killer running away, looking kind of gay-like, I guess is the best way to put it, in the way he's running for a guy, that's because it actually was a female stunt double running. So that explains it. IMDb gave this a 3.7 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 10%. Letterboxd a 1.5 out of 5. And I give it a 1 out of 5. And that brings us to the final movie of the episode. And that is 1981's Night School.
When darkness descends on the city, something happens to the girls who attend night school.
You're not walking home alone tonight, are you? After what happened?
We'll be all right.
Something secret.
Modern man has only to take a short step to wind up in the primeval jungle of his ancestors.
Something forbidding.
Well, we've had a few kooks in Boston in our time, but headhunters are too many.
Thank you.
Ann Barron is a teacher's aide at a daycare center in Boston. One evening, she is relaxing on the playground carousel when someone pulls up on a motorcycle wearing a black motorcycle helmet. She is startled as a stranger pulls out a knife and starts spinning the carousel. The terrified Ann goes around until the knife hits her. Lieutenant Judd Austin is the policeman assigned to the case. As he gets to the scene, he sees the girl decapitated with her head in a nearby bucket. The distraught director of the center tells Judd that Ann worked there during the day and was attending night classes at Wendell College. At the hospital, Judd and his partner Taj discover a similar case from the previous week in which another girl was found decapitated with her head in a pond. They wonder if there is any connection between the two murders. While at Wendell, the administrator, Helen Griffin, tells Judd that Ann was close to a girl named Kim Morrison. When asked if Ann had a boyfriend, Kim tells Judd that Ann was indeed involved with someone, but she doesn't know who. Judd enters Professor Millett's anthropology class to speak with him about Ann, but the professor doesn't provide much information, but he does introduce Judd to an exchange student named Eleanor Agi. Eleanor leaves the school and goes to the local diner. There, she is creeped out by Gary, the busboy who appears to have mental issues. The waitress Carol asks Eleanor if she's in Millett's class and implies that he sleeps around, irritating Eleanor, so she leaves. Gary then follows her home. When she realizes this, she runs the rest of the way and quickly locks her door. She gets into the shower, but someone tries to break in. Frightened, she gets out of the shower, only to find that it's Professor Millett, her boyfriend, who had been locked out by accident. Then Kim goes to work at the local aquarium. About to leave work, she takes off her diving suit and is decapitated by the figure in a motorcycle helmet. A woman who was previously looking at the turtle screams after she sees Kim's head fall in the tank. Judd pays a visit to Professor Millett and is surprised to see Eleanor, who explains that she is his research assistant. Judd then informs Millett that a second student of his has been killed and asks him if he has any affairs with his pupils. Annoyed by the question, Millett tells Judd to leave. Eleanor and Millett then get into an argument and she goes to the diner to be alone. The professor follows her and she tells him that she is 3 months pregnant. He's sympathetic, although he still manages to flirt with Carol. After the diner has closed, Carol is left to clean up. When the power goes out, she heads to the basement to investigate, and the killer appears and attacks her. Carol escapes, but is then caught in an alley and killed. The next day, Carol's head is found in a water-filled sink and her body in a dumpster. Judd and Taj then go to Gary's house, since he is now considered a prime suspect, but Judd doesn't believe he was involved. When Judd goes to Professor Millett's home again, he finds a collection of skulls taken from tribal headhunters from around the world. Eleanor doesn't see anything wrong with this, and at Wendell, Helen tells Millett to stop sleeping around with his students and counsels student Kathy, who confesses that she too has been intimate with the professor. Helen invites the girl to spend a night at her house, resulting in the two sleeping together. Helen is killed when she gets up to answer the phone, and Kathy is killed shortly after discovering Helen's head in the toilet. Judd is on his way to speak to Helen when he sees the killer fleeing. He chases the killer to Professor Millett's apartment. Inside, the killer is revealed to be, in fact, Eleanor. She confesses the killings to her boyfriend and justifies the crimes by comparing them to tribal rituals he teaches in his courses. As the police are approaching, Millett pulls on the helmet and flees on his motorcycle to divert the suspicion from Eleanor. During a chase with Judd and Taj, Millett is struck by a car and killed. Eleanor then attends his burial, and the police believe the case has been solved, although it is implied that Judd suspects Eleanor was the killer and Millett sacrificed his life to protect her. However, the case is closed, and Eleanor moves back to England. After the case is closed, Judd gets in his car and is suddenly attacked by the killer, only to reveal it was a prank by Taj, and the end credits roll. Although this slasher has become a cult classic over the years, despite it being torn apart by critics when it was first released, it's still pretty relatively unknown by people outside of slasher fan circles. But it's really not anything special. I mean, it's a typical run-of-the-mill slasher, like everything else in the 80s was, pretty much. Except, well, even the decapitations aren't really that special because they had been done in other slashers as well. The twist ending is pretty fucking predictable. If you're used to these kinds of movies, you'll see it coming a mile away. And the acting is pretty stiff. It's kind of like the actors are all uncomfortable and would rather be doing something else. But having said all that, this isn't a particularly bad movie. It's a lot better than a lot of the slashers that would come out in the following years. It's not the world's best, but it's also not the world's worst either. So it's definitely worth a watch if you should come across it while flipping through channels or a streaming service or whatever. It is on cable every now and then. And I think some streaming services stream it during Halloween as well. This had a budget of $1.2 million and brought in $1.6 million at the box office. IMDb gives us a 5.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, 46%. Letterboxd, a 2.5 out of 5. And I give it a 2.5 out of 5 as well. And that just about wraps it up for me, guys. As always, you can reach me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.